shucking jive.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
Hello, race fans. Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. Hope y'all doing fine tonight. My name is Jeff Gilder. I'm going to be the host. Let's get around quickly and see who's here. Out west, all the way from Dawsonville, Georgia, the man is here with us tonight, Mr. Cody Densmore. Cody, how are you?
I'm just fine. Good to be here.
Good to see you too. Good to see you too, man. Good. What's going on, Cody? What's the weather like in Dawsonville? Let's figure that out right off the bat.
It's a little damp right now.
As in East Tennessee, we call it damp, okay?
All right. It's a little bit of that right now.
We call it wet here.
But we definitely need it, so I can't complain.
All right. Coming east to the lair, the legend is there. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing great. Thank you, sir. Glad to be here. Glad to have another Tuesday night to unwind.
You bet you wound up?
Oh, yeah. Always. Man, always.
You can't be being wound up now at your age. You need to stay calm.
It
ain't good for you to be so wound up.
You know? I ain't worried about it.
You ain't worried about it?
I ain't too worried.
Well, if you ain't worried about it, I ain't going to worry about it either.
Don't worry about it. I'm telling you, don't worry about it.
You got a legendorial for us tonight?
I do, yes, sir.
What's it about?
It is entitled Signposts, Tie Bridges, and Cocoa Krispies.
Cool.
Okay. That sounds interesting. I can't wait to see what's happening after that.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, cool. All right.
Is TV up? I can't seem to.
It will be as soon as I get finished pasting the code in there. I was trying to get y'all to talk so I could work.
All right, we can talk. Let's talk.
No, I'm done
hey,
now.
Hey, Bobby. Hey, Jack.
I'm done
hey,
now.
You.
I'm hey. Done now. All right. Hey, the man on the streets here, Hewlin Oval Crash, Splitter Hughes, the man that brings you Hughes Views on the News. How yep. you doing tonight, Hughes?
I'm doing just fine.
Good,
the
man.
Weather is warming up. I got a chance to ride my trike for a while this afternoon, so I'm in good spirits.
You rode your what?
Trike. As in motorcycle being made into a three-wheeler.
Oh, I thought you said track for a minute. I thought you was on a trico or something.
Moto Guzzi.
Hey, don't use that word. It's a Honda.
Is it a Moto Guzzi?
No, it's a Honda.
It's a Moto Guzzi.
If it was a Moto Guzzi, it'd be worth something.
Yeah. So in my Honda.
Oh, yeah. Come on. All right, to his left,
Guzzi.
The man who invented the endless warranty from Bobby's Auto Parts, the Boppers here, Mr. Bobby Williamson. How you doing tonight, sir?
Hey, Jeff, what a crowd.
What a crowd, man. It's a great crowd here tonight, man. Packed house tonight, fellas. We got a packed house.
What a show. What a crowd.
Packed in here like sardines, man.
Buckshot would say like cordwood.
Like cordwood.
Stacked in that first turn like cordwood.
Like cordwood. That's where they're at, man. They're in there like cordwood.
Whatever happened to Buckshot Jones?
Buckshot Jones.
We don't know.
He's probably still around Atlanta.
He wasn't the real Buckshot.
No.
He didn't last long, did he?
No, he was a flash in the pan.
He was a flash in the
like
pan.
Buckshot.
He was. So.
Reminds me of some sponsors I have known.
We'll get into that in a minute. Coastal Jack Walker is in the house tonight. How you doing tonight, CJ?
Doing okay, man.
You got a historic race place.
Oh, yeah.
Where are we going tonight, buddy?
We are going to Columbia, South Carolina.
Oh, one of my favorite places.
But it may not be what you expect.
Really?
And I'm not saying any more. Do we
There's a teaser for you. That's what we call it in the business, folks. That's a teaser right there. Yes, sir. That's all right.
Well,
he
came in here with his sweater and his polished dancing loafers. So I don't know what we'll expect out of Jack tonight.
Never can tell, man.
Shaggers outfit.
I told you, boys. I'm gonna go on record right now. Uh-oh. I told you, boys, that you need to eat more of those freaking fig bars. And y'all wouldn't listen to me.
We tried.
And now we've lost our chance.
We ate them until they was running out our ears, and it apparently didn't do any good.
We did our part.
Maybe we were the only ones that bought them.
Maybe.
I bought a bunch of them now.
I know.
Yeah, if you didn't.
Trying to do my part, man. Showing my loyalty to
poor Danica.
Nature's fig bars.
Yeah. What else is going on out there in the world? Anybody want to start a commentary? Bobby, you look like you've got something to say.
Well, that's the biggest story.
Well, let's go ahead and elaborate on that thing, will you?
Nature's fig bars they wrote a letter to Stuart Haas basically reneging on their contract. And so.
Does that mean that Danica was not selling fig bars for the company?
Well,
I believe what started it all was that when the Stuart Haas had their media day, she was in a tax act suit instead of the fig bar suit.
Ouch.
And I was just looking over Jayski here about 10 minutes ago, looking at some of the new paint schemes, because Lord knows we're not going to know who is in what car. Daytona time, and they didn't even have the car listed on Jayski.
Yeah, they said she wasn't doing her figging part.
They took her figging money back. Yeah. Hey, and that was, so you say she was in a tax act outfit, but we don't know if Stuart Haas already knew that they weren't getting paid.
When the first official word came was Stuart Haas released a statement that said that they were in discussions with Nature's Bakery over the topic of what the sponsorship might quote unquote look like in 2017. What Danica's sponsorship might look
so
like.
When was that?
That was about last Thursday.
Okay.
The next day they filed lawsuit for a breach of contract, suing for $31.7 million.
So apparently the figging people told them this is what it's gonna look like.
So but now here's my question, and I'm not a legal expert, but here's my question. This is, if somebody don't have $15 million,
yeah,
they're already threw in the towel because obviously they couldn't hang with that. Which,
yeah,
how in the world? What kind of sense does it make to sue them for 31.7?
Well, there's a whole lot of suing that's never made any sense to me now when it comes to that.
But I mean, I'm just asking, what? Yeah. How does the law?
Well, they might. They may not have that cash, but they might have assets
maybe Tony Stewart and Haas want to go into the fig bar making equipment,
that could be
business, and so they're bound to get their equipment so they can make Stuart Haas fig bars and etc.
Well, fellas, you heard it right here. We ask our panel of experts here, how's that ever going to work?
When that sponsorship was first announced, whenever it was, 2015 or whenever it was,
yeah,
we were aghast and dumbfounded.
We were of an unusual consensus that we predicted rather swift failure.
Well, I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I thought, well, that must be some really good fig bars, so I went and bought a bunch of them.
And we found out that I'm not going to say that.
I thought they were pretty good. Now, I mean, you guys just got them on Tuesday nights. I ate them the rest of the month.
Obviously, you weren't eating enough.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. But I ate them. I thought they were pretty good.
Oh, they weren't bad.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, though. This is the school of thought. This is what they were thinking. All right, we're Nature's Fig Bars, and our mode of operation is healthy eating, lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Which that's all well and good. So what we need is a spokesperson, someone that embodies our philosophy, and they decided that was Danica Patrick.
Yeah.
And so it was going to cost $15 million a year to do that, but they thought that the extra sales
of this
idea was going to make up the slack. There's where the...
So apparently Danica did not sell fig bars.
Obviously not.
Yeah.
I mean, and they didn't have the pockets to keep on wagging with it, like I'm sure some sponsors have done until they finally could woozle out of the deal.
Yeah.
They had to throw in the towel at the first opportunity.
Huh. Well, let me ask you this. If it was $15 million, how much is Monster paying to sponsor the whole shebang? Because wasn't Sprint paying $10 million a year? or something?
No, it was more than that.
Yeah, it was a lot more.
Cody, what I read somewhere is Sprint was paying $50 million a year, and Monster is now paying $25 million a year. That's well, what I read.
I heard, but you know, 20.
How fake news goes.
Yeah, we don't have any of that here. If we don't know, we'll tell you. We don't know, but we'll tell you our opinion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I read that somewhere, but I can't even recall where I read it now.
Huh. Yeah, Monster had signed. I'm not Monster, but Nature's Bakery was in it for 3 years.
Yeah.
So what Stuart Haas is wanting, I guess they paid the first year, the 15 million. They're wanting the other 2 years, which would be another 30-something million.
Yep.
So why in the first place did they get mad? Is that because they want to be the primary sponsor and for Media Day they weren't the primary sponsor?
If you go back to it, Nature's Bakery or whatever on January 9th said, "That's it, we're out of here." So that, you know, that's why she was wearing the Tax Slayer suit on whatever the press day was, which was what, like January 21st or no, 20th or something?
Yeah, and on the Tax Slayer is her sponsor for three races this year.
Yeah.
That is not, I mean.
Well, I frankly thought it was seven, but again, I'm not up with everything.
Yeah, so to settle that she wore the Tax Slayer outfit, they already knew that the Figgin people were out.
They were out. And today, Ford announced that they will pick up the slack to keep Danica going this year.
She's going to have a Greg Biffle car then.
Probably
on it half the year.
No matter how the Nature's Fig Bar deal works out, they're going to keep her going. So
they figure if she can't sell Fig Bar, she might sell Fords.
Right.
That's the thinking.
Or something. I didn't say that.
That's the thinking.
Interesting logic. I mean, how much does a Fig Bar cost?
You got to sell a lot of Fig Bars.
Yeah, but you don't have to sell as many Fords.
That's true.
But how many Fig Bars? How many Fig Bars you got to sell to pay? I guess it would be $45 million for 3 years.
Yeah, probably about 180 million Fig Bars.
A lot of Fig Bars.
A whole lot of fig trees.
That would call it a world fig shortage.
You probably have to sell one to half the people in the United States.
More than once.
Well, now, you know, if I was Stuart Haas, when this whole deal first got off the ground, I would be skeptical. Like, how y'all can't do this?
Yeah,
we appreciate you wanting to do it and your enthusiasm and all of that.
Give us the $15 million. We'll go ahead and have our lawyers start on this lawsuit for the second and third year.
But can you get blood out of a turnip is my question. I mean, they can sue them.
It's principle. Yeah. You can't let them off the hook.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
They said they had upheld their end of the deal, which I guess they had, Stuart Haas.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, somebody mentioned on the chat line they had, and it depends on what the contract said, when you finish an average of 24th throughout the season, that's not a front runner. That's not something that gets a whole lot of TV time. Is it worth $15 million a year for a 24th place finish?
Well, that's what we were saying back when they announced
exactly.
it. How is Danica Patrick and where she runs ever going to?
And how could they not know that?
Yeah.
If you're getting ready to spend $45 million, I think I would have done some research of what I was. But obviously neither them nor Stuart Haas did.
Yeah.
My only question is, if I'm Nature's Bakery, and if I've got a lot of money and I'm spending $15 million a year, why not step up another $5 or $10 million and do the whole series? You know,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, that makes
you
all kinds.
Be sued
of
just as bad.
Yeah. Yeah. You get sued by people with deeper pockets.
The Figgin Cup.
Oh God.
The Figgin NASCAR.
Well, a lot of people say that's what it is now.
That's right.
Give me that Figgin Cup.
If I was the Fig Bar people, I would have had Danica out there on the track in front of everybody and dressed in fig leaves.
Say, you dirty old man.
Hey, whatever works.
I'm not sure that would work.
Yeah, me either. Let's get on with it. Cody.
One year she won the pole to Daytona. Remember that?
At one time at band camp.
1 year.
Yeah.
One time she won
you're
the pole.
You talking about me.
So.
In the fig leaf special.
Cody.
Yes, sir.
We're going to you first tonight, man, since you were here early and everything. What do you got on your mind?
Well, nothing too much. Nothing too much, really.
All right.
You see, that's pretty quick.
Next.
Someone's got to initiate the conversation, and then you get me going.
Oh, okay. So you want to wait a couple more positions before we come to you?
Sure.
All right.
When I race, I don't like to go out and lead first off. I like to save my equipment for the last little bit of the race.
All right, you got it, pal. That's what we'll do then. All right, so up next, we got Hugh's views on the news and everything there is to do with the news. Take it away, Hugh.
Well, we've covered about everything that I had to talk about.
Next. Folks, we got a heck of a show lined up for you tonight.
I have time to sign off, isn't it?
I do want to throw one thing out and see if anybody knows, because I don't and I haven't done the research. Does anybody know, number one, is Clint Bowyer going to run for Stuart Haas this coming year? And if so, does he bring his 5-Hour Energy sponsorship with him?
It is my understanding that is correct.
Well, I had heard that way back, but I hadn't heard anything recently. And with all of the no-shows and the fold-ups this year, I didn't know whether that was going to come.
Well, you know, Eric Jones has 5-Hour Energy for this year. He's running with Furniture Row.
For this year, as in 17?
Yes.
He has 5-Hour Energy?
That's Eric Jones has run the number 77 car.
Second car for Furniture Row.
Yes, well, I knew he's running 5-Hour Energy.
Well, that's news to me. I certainly did not know that, Cody.
Bowyer that too?
I believe they dropped Bowyer and went with Eric Jones. And from what I've heard, this may be the year Kenseth steps out, because it's just a one-year deal for Eric Jones with Furniture Row, and they want to move him to Joe Gibbs for 2018, because this is just a one-year contract.
Well, that still brings my question. Is Clint Bowyer going to run for Stuart Haas, and if so, who's his sponsor going to be?
Mobil 1.
He's definitely going to run for Stuart Haas.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in the Mobil 1 car, which is Tony Stewart's car.
He's going to step in. What's his car number going to be? Will he be in the 14?
Yes.
Or the 15?
Yes, 14.
14.
Okay. So,
Michael Waltrip's going to run a number 15 for the Daytona 500, and that's going to be his last race.
Good. Yay. I mean, okay. Well, that makes sense if they've got the Mobil 1 sponsorship, mm-hmm. And 5-Hour Energy obviously is okay with it. So this will only be a one-year deal. Then,
for Eric,
Eric Jones.
Jones
moves to who?
Supposedly Joe Gibbs, and they're thinking he might take Kenseth's spot since he's the oldest one on the team. But Bowyer has, I believe, a 3-year contract to drive the 14 car.
Okay. But it may not necessarily be the 14 Mobil 1 car for that 3 years. He just has a contract to drive a car for 3 years, right?
It's my understanding he's in the 14 Mobil 1 car for 3 years.
Oh, okay.
All right, your time's up. Now it's my turn.
All right, take it away, Jeff.
I have content tonight.
Oh, good.
You do. Yep.
Put it on us.
And let me direct you to where you can follow along with it if you would like. If you're on racersreunion.com, click on the blog page or click on the activity page, whichever one you want to go to. But if you go to the activity page, go to the blog section, which is on the left-hand side. And there is a blog there from our Alex from Florida. Congratulations on the diploma or whatever you call that, Master of Science degree, your degree, Mr. Alex. But the problem with racing, all of it, not just part of it, but all of it. I'm going to read this, okay? I'm going to read this to the audience. 13 out of 16, and depending on who you ask, all 16 of IndyCar's races, will inevitably feature harder racing and more intensity than any race you will find NASCAR or IMSA to run. The problem isn't what you think it is. The villain, the length of the races. We mentioned this before the show tonight, Jack.
Yeah,
remember?
Somebody sure did, didn't they?
Yeah, how about that? So one of the greatest challenges in racing was having a car that was fast enough to win and reliable enough to finish. To finish first, you had to first finish. In his career, Junior Johnson suffered 132 mechanical failure DNFs and 33 crash DNFs in 313 races. In his career, Jeff Gordon only had 99 DNFs total, with 37 mechanical failure DNFs and 62 crash DNFs in 806 races. For Gordon, he had 9 handling, most of which were due to accident damage, 2 fuel pumps, and 1 ignition. The rest of his mechanical problems were engine. Johnson broke 3 A-frames, 4 axles, 2 ball joints, 1 battery cable, 5 bearings, 1 brake cylinder, 1 set of brakes, 1 bumper, 1 carburetor, 6 clutches, 1 coil, 1 control arm, 2 differentials, 2 distributors, 1 fan belt, that's amazing, 1 fuel line, 2 fuel pumps, 2 gas tanks, 2 ignitions, 1 kingpin, he probably lost it, 1 oil leak, 1 oil pan, 6 pistons, and 1 multiple piston failure. He also was disqualified twice, suffered fatigue once, and quit once due to accident damage. He suffered 14 overheating issues and blew 28 engines.
I thought it was more than that.
Granted, Junior was the king of breaking stuff, but Mr. Wait and Strike himself, David Pearson, had 204 DNFs in his career, of which 41 were crash, 1 was non-start, 2 were disqualifications, 1 because he quit. The car itself broke 159 times in his 574 starts. Extrapolating, he would have extrapolating. Okay, he would have 286 rounding down mechanical DNFs. If he ran 806 races, or almost 8 times as many as Jeff Gordon, extrapolated for you there. Okay, extrapolated for you. Last weekend, the Rolex 24 was a debacle due to a BOP change, whatever the heck that is.
What
it wasn't
that
publicized
mean?
Until the middle of the race. And fans got to watch 41 out of 54 cars finish a 24-hour race with 17 cars across 3 class with 25 laps of overall winner. In 2007, 25 laps down would have gotten you 8th overall. In 1998, it would have gotten you 3rd overall, as the actual 3rd overall car, a Porsche 911 GT1, was 44 laps behind the winner and 33 cars finishing, albeit most 100 through of 516 laps off pace. Danny Ongais, Hurley Haywood, and Ted Field drove the Zero Interscope Racing Porsche 935-79 to victory in 1979 by 49 laps over the Ferrari 365 GTB4 of John Morton and Tony Adamowicz, with 9th overall, 105 laps down, 14 cars finishing. Mechanical reliability has rendered the endurance of racing meaningless. 24-hour races are now worthless. Never mind 500-mile races. As such, having such races in these series really is pointless. Worthless, pointless, meaningless. He says it all right there. The only difference is that you need 3 drivers to run a 24-hour race effectively, but Louis Rozier drove all but 2 laps in winning Le Mans in 1950. This is why there is no effort seen in NASCAR races. The cars will finish, so they might as well wait for the late debris yellow and charging late. This is why NASCAR is giving points at the one quarter and half points to encourage racing prior to that late debris yellow. I think NASCAR would be better served by the unused proposal: split the field for 2 25 to 50 mile heat races and pay points, and then run 150 to 200 mile feature that pays even more points. This system could be used across all 3 touring series. Each series could be a one-day show with a 60-minute practice, 15-minute qualifying, heats, and then the race. Run clean. Fans could arrive at 10 or 11 a.m. and be out by 4 p.m. Trucks on Friday night, Saturday afternoon, NXS Saturday morning, Saturday late afternoon, and Cup on Sunday. And with the rate both series are losing vehicles, maybe we'll see Cup and trucks running combo races soon. Edit. Note that this could also be applied to sports car racing. Why run any races longer than 2 hours? Now, Alex, I thought, hit on something we've talked about several times. I agree with him 100%. 100% across the board. I think that, that you know, when you compare racing then to racing now, and the endurance thing is gone, you know. Cars are going to last. What's the point?
That's very true.
Yeah. It's pointless, as he said, meaningless, and worthless. Nice job, Alex. Comments?
Well, I can remember seeing lots of the older races where axles broke, wheels broke, transmissions, drive shafts literally fell out of the cars. That you're absolutely correct. The reliability factor has gone up by more than 100%. So the endurance factor just isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
So now let's run a little short sprint races.
Right. That's what we're saying here. Yeah. We've covered the subject in here before.
Yep.
I don't know anybody that totally disagrees with it. What's the problem with it? The problem with it is shorter races means less time to advertise the sponsors, and we already have sponsor issues with the series. We have not only, but that's not the root of the sponsor problem. The root of the sponsor problem is the loyalty issue.
Well, and cost.
The loyalty issue went away when they kicked the loyal fans to the curb and went looking for new ones. I mean, they used to have fans that bought sponsors' products.
Yep. Exactly.
And as late as in the 80s, NASCAR fans, 70% of them said they bought the sponsors' products, you know? And I think that was true into the 90s, but that's not true today.
No.
No.
There's very few.
The distance has really lost its mystique.
Yeah, there's no reason to do it.
Granted, there was a time when that was alluring, that was attractive. The 500-mile moniker just sounded like racing.
Because what car can run 500 miles?
It really was an endurance contest.
Well, it was endurance. Endurance was the biggest part of it.
And it really struck a chord in that era. Yeah. People loved it. But, you know, the thing is, as Tim pointed out in one of his posts, that the world has changed.
Yeah.
And that is so true. And, I mean, it's not just changed and then stopped. It's continually evolving seemingly, you know, faster. And I think it's evolved out of what was popular. I mean, that don't resonate anymore, the 500-mile, 24-hour, all that stuff.
Yeah, there is a phrase that I plagiarized. I can't remember where I heard it, but I heard a marketing guy say, if you're going to make it in any business nowadays, you have to adopt a marketing in the now mentality. And you have to know what's relevant now and what works right now. And you have to understand that it may stop working as early as tomorrow.
Exactly.
You know, so you can't wait for the fad to pass or for the next best thing to come along. If there's opportunity now, you take it and you be flexible and you be ready to change.
Look at Kodak. They were big time NASCAR sponsors.
Look at the Fig Bar Company.
Right. And now Kodak has been declared irrelevant. I mean, it doesn't exist.
They're not even a company.
Yeah, they were on top of the world. They were the camera and film place to go, and now they don't even exist.
Yep.
Poof.
Digital age killed them. So I'm going to cover this one more time, then we got to move along because we run out of time. But we had this discussion many, many times here. It was back in 2012 or so when American mainstream said, oh, my gosh, we have smartphones. Old people aren't going to be able to use them and get on the Internet. We need to change all of our marketing to the 18 to 24-year-olds. Okay? NASCAR changed their reported demographic pretty much overnight when that happened. Okay, that's where all of this started. So they thought they weren't marketing in the now because their old fans were still there. They were still buying those exorbitantly priced tickets, and they were still fans. But when NASCAR made that change and decided to follow Budweiser and everybody else
and kick their fans to the curb
and go after the 18 to 24-year-olds, they started the downward spiral. Now, they had issues. Okay, they've been fighting issues since all kinds of things, the chase and everything else, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back, in my opinion. You'll never convince me that it was anything else.
Well, there was another factor, and that was that they had been under, whether it was justified or not, some pressure to clean up the infields to get the rednecks and the
They brought that all on themselves, man.
Confederate flags and all that stuff.
No, that's all that political
off the track. Yeah,
political correctness BS that the world was into then.
Yeah, and they let themselves be swayed by that, and that chased off a great deal of their fans that they'll never get back.
All right, so that was good. Alex, thank you for posting that, man. I thought you did an excellent job. Some great historical facts are in there. I know I read it fast, and I probably mispronounced some words. So,
I like that extrapolating.
Extrapolating.
I got to remember that.
It sounds like a Bobby's Auto Parts.
Yeah. So y'all go in there and get you some of that. Coastal Jack Walker, the Carolina Race Place Historic Race Finish, is up next, man. Brought to you in part by Bobby's Auto Parts, fresh out of the archives of the Carolina Race Place .zoomshare.com.
We're extrapolating.
Let's extrapolate where we're going tonight.
We're going to polate to Columbia, South Carolina tonight. We are going to the 250-lap Mark New Car Race, October 28th, 1961.
Way back.
1961, all the way to October.
Yeah.
Wow. It's got Mark sanctioning body.
It's got some interesting things going on
here. The Wayback Machine.
In July of 1961, Curtis Turner was banned from NASCAR by Bill France for attempting to unionize the drivers. Turner was out of racing for 3 months before joining with John Markham to promote three Midwest Association of Race Car Sanctioned Races in the South. Turner announced he would promote those races at Lakewood Speedway in Atlanta on October 22nd, Columbia Speedway on October 28th, and Birmingham Speedway on November 5th. At Lakewood, the New Car Mark race, promoted by Turner, attracted 15,000 spectators to watch 26 new car starting field. The current Mark new car champion Harold Smith of Dayton, Ohio, won the race driving a 1961 Chevrolet. The following week, the circuit was off to Columbia, South Carolina for the 250-lap new car race at the Half Mile Clay Columbia Speedway. Heavy promotion was going on in Columbia leading up to the Saturday night race. On Thursday, Turner, Phoney Flock, and actress June Wilkinson, 40-21-36, showed up.
That 21 is amazing, man. Yeah.
Showed up.
Extrapolating.
As I said, on Thursday, Turner, Phoney Flock, and actress June Wilkinson, 40-21-36, showed up at the sports editor's office of the state newspaper. That was worth a quarter page write-up in Friday's newspaper by Bob Talbert, including photos of Turner and June Wilkinson, 40-21-36, doing the twist. On race day, 24 drivers ran time trials at Columbia Speedway for the 250-lap race. Included in the field was Curtis Turner driving a brand-new 1962 Holman and Moody Ford. Tim Flock in a 1961 Ford he purchased from the Wood Brothers. Harold Smith, the current Mark champion, in a 61 Chevrolet. And Charlie Glotzback in a 1960 Pontiac. 5,200 fans paid $4 each of what was described as one of the best races ever at Columbia Speedway. The race had several lead changes by drivers Harold Smith, Tom Drew, Phil Coron, Paul Parks, Tim Flock, and Curtis Turner. Clyde Parker broke a spindle on lap 160, ending his day. Paul Parks blew an engine on lap 181. Drivers Tim Flock, Phil Coron, and Harold Smith blew tires and spun off the track. Near the end of the race, Tom Drew, driving a 1961 Ford owned by Johnny Beauchamp, blew a tire, spun off the track, overturned, and hit a teenager sitting on the fence. The teenager, Jonah Struckers of West Columbia, was taken to the hospital with serious conditions. With 36 laps to go, Curtis Turner, driving a 1962 Ford, took the lead and held on to the checkered flag on lap 250. This was the first race victory in the United States for a 1962 model car. Turner won $1,075 from the $5,000 purse. So here's the way they finished in Columbia, South Carolina, October 28th, 1961, the Mark New Car Race Series, 250 laps. Curtis Turner, Roanoke, Virginia, in a 62 Ford, followed by Keith Plug, Indianapolis, Indiana, a 61 Ford, Cleo Ashby, Southfield, Michigan, a 60 Ford, Charlie Glotzbach, Louisville, Kentucky, in a 60 Pontiac, Paul Wessink, Desher, Ohio, in a 60 Dodge. I'm going to skip the sixth place driver for right now, come back to him later. Junior Jones finished seventh from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in a 60 Pontiac. Fawny Flock, Atlanta, Georgia, 61 Pontiac. Tim Flock, Charlotte, North Carolina, a 61 Ford. Tom Drew, Peoria, Illinois, a 61 Ford. And the following drivers were in the race, but no finishing position was listed. Harold Smith, Dayton, Ohio, a 61 Chevrolet. Phil Cronin, Houston, Texas, 61 Ford. Paul Parks, Columbus, Ohio, a 60 Ford. Clyde Parker, Detroit, Michigan, a 61 Chevrolet. Homer Newland, Detroit, Michigan, a 60 Ford. Harold Kite, Atlanta, Georgia, a 60 Ford. Bob James, Akron, Ohio, a 60 Plymouth. Iggy Katona, Willis, Michigan, a 61 Ford. Jerry Jones, Peoria, Illinois, a 60 Pontiac. Wilbur Rakeshaw, Dallas, Georgia, a 60 Ford. Ken Finley, Chicago, Illinois, a 61 Ford. Ernie Durr, Keokuk, Iowa, a 61 Pontiac. Bob Talley, Chicago, Illinois, a 61 Ford. And Bob May, Cleveland, Ohio, a 61 Chevrolet. The driver I skipped, Bobby, was in the sixth position, listed in two different bylines that I found in articles written, listed as Junior Johnson, Columbia, South Carolina. Well, we know that there's a Junior Johnson from Rhonda, North Carolina, but he won a race in Greenville that same day, so we know that wasn't him. And then we know there's a Junior Johnson from Florence, South Carolina, and I don't know, it may have been him.
Where was he listed from?
Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay, which that could have been sort of a typo.
Yeah, could have. And there was also a driver named Ken Johnson from Buffalo, New York, that ran some of these Mark races. So I don't know.
So did Mark became ARCA?
Mark became ARCA in 1964, 2 years later.
Because John Markham was later. He was the chief official of.
Yep.
Him and Bill France had always sort of been colleagues.
And then they kind of went their separate ways for a while. And Turner, though, said in several articles that he wanted to come back in 1962 and race as many as 15 races in the South. Basically, he said there was room for two major sanctioning bodies in the South.
So. And that was a Holman and Moody car?
Holman and Moody, a brand new 1962 Ford in October of 1961.
One of the things I noticed about it when you were reading the first part of it was that, yes, that was an endurance race. Look at the stuff that broke.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a – how long was that track?
Half mile.
Half mile. So it was only 125 miles.
Yeah.
And yet there were quite a few mechanical failures.
Oh, yeah. And one serious injury.
Yeah.
But
that was to a fan.
Yeah, to a fan.
All right. Good stuff. Thank you. Who wants to go next? Bobby, Tim, raise your hand.
Tim, you go.
All right.
Okay, we'll go. February 7th, 2017, Legendorial Signpost, Hot Ridges and Cocoa Krispies. Rod Serling would introduce the Friday night 10 p.m. episode of The Twilight Zone each week from 1959 through 1964, including the line, quoting now, "There's a signpost up ahead," end quote. I was a huge fan of that show, as was my Uncle Bobby's wife, Mary, whom we called Mary Ruth because she was a two-name person, plain and simple. Uncle Bobby was only 11 years older than I, and Mary was 5 years younger than Uncle Bobby, so she and I got along really well. What a sweet and beautiful woman she was. Even when she was battling cancer that eventually took her from us, she was always up for some shenanigans for laughs. So in February 1962, Uncle Bobby decided we would go to Daytona for the Sportsman Race on Saturday and the 500 on Sunday. Problem was, in order to do that, we had to leave Columbia after the two of them got off work on Friday. Then Mary remembered that the Twilight Zone was on, and the episode for that week was supposed to be a really good one. So the plan was made that we would all be packed and ready to go as soon as the ending music started for the Twilight Zone. We would be in that 57 Plymouth headed southbound to Daytona. The show ended. We flew out the door and jumped in the Plymouth. That was the night the fog came in from the depths of hell, or perhaps London. But from wherever it came, it was thick. Southbound on US 321, and we were looking for the signpost, get the Twilight Zone reference here, that would direct us on to Highway 17A South. By the time we were approaching the Georgia line, the fog was so thick, you could barely see those little chrome blades on the fenders of that Plymouth. But we pushed on. Now, let me interject here with the fact that I am terrified of heights. Unbelievably terrified. I remember when I was 8, my daddy drove us across the old Cooper River Bridge in Charleston. Oh. I hid at the back floorboard of that 48 Dodge and vowed I was not going back across that bridge. When my daddy said he would find me an orphanage in Mount Pleasant, I decided a second trip hiding in the floorboard might not be so bad. But let me tell you about that bridge crossing that river going into Georgia. It was foggy. I actually could not see the bridge, but I began to feel the sensation of going up. Suddenly, we broke through the fog, being so high we were above it, and I was terrified. Closed my eyes as we started the descent into Georgia. I spent a good part of the weekend trying to talk Uncle Bobby into finding an alternative route back home. We crossed into Florida just as the sun was beginning to paint the sky with whatever colors it uses. As being colorblind, I have no idea other than what the poets write about sunrises. About the time Mary spotted a roadside pullover, so we decided to stop for breakfast. We had packed all kind of food, including milk and Cocoa Krispies cereal. As I sat on that concrete bench, eating cereal from a plastic bowl on the round concrete table, Uncle Bobby said it was about 100 more miles to Daytona. The sun was shining brightly by this time, and we knew the rest of the trip would be fast, because Bobby drove fast, very fast. It was not long before we were in the short line entering the infield tunnel, where the guy was standing there selling tickets off a roll of tickets. We entered the dark tunnel and popped out the other side directly into such bright sunshine. I knew everything I'd ever heard about sunny Florida was true. We watched the Sportsman and Modified race and marveled at those aerodynamic Studebakers fly away from the field. I don't remember who won that race, but I'm sure it was a Studebaker. I want to say it was Leroy Yarborough, but his wins may have come later in that event. The 500 was awesome. That black and gold Pontiac 22 driven by Fireball Roberts was uncatchable. But hanging on to the back bumper of the 22 was that petty blue Plymouth 43 tucked in the draft. Watching that sort of reminded me of that song about the Little Nash Rambler, but I'm not sure that song was even out yet. Yes, I love to share these memories, and it's probably not the first time you heard the story, but to me it means much. I'll leave the details of Slappy's Motel and having to cross that dang bridge again for another day. But as I sit here this afternoon, I wish it was another foggy night in February, and that old 57 Plymouth was making its way south again. Something that could happen if this were the Twilight Zone. I guess the subject of the fog came to mind this week because I feel we are heading into a really thick fog as NASCAR approaches this new season. But I also have the feeling, just like that February in 1962, that the sun is going to rid us of that fog, and we are going to have a brilliantly sunny season for racing. It's a different world now, but the passion that was Fireball Roberts and so many others is still there with some. And with some of us older fans, the passion burns brightly as ever. They say never, optimistic. Okay, fog, time for you to dissipate, and time for the Florida sun to shine on my sport. After all, Mary Ruth wouldn't have it any other way in her world. Thank you, Jeff. Back to you. Wasn't much to that, but memories.
Oh, that was great, man. That was really cool.
Thank you.
You sure have a way with titles.
Cocoa Puff.
All right, Bopper.
Tim, my dad went to that race, the 62 Daytona 500. Yep. Yeah, I think that was the first time he had went to Daytona, but I remember, you know, Richard finished second, and there was some controversy that supposedly Lee Petty had a photograph that showed too many people over the wall in the Fireball Roberts Smoky Eunuch pits. Do you remember that?
That is true. That is true, and he filed an official protest, and I think NASCAR waited 2 days before they disallowed the protest, but the six men could go over the wall, and there was no incontrovertible evidence said there were seven men working on that Pontiac.
Yeah, and that's the way I remember it. I remember Dad come back, and there was some glimmer of hope that Richard might be declared the winner, you know, depending on how the protest went.
Yeah, I had that glimmer of hope.
I can, yeah.
Didn't come to fruition.
Yeah, we had a 57 Plymouth too.
Oh, did you?
A Plymouth Fury.
This one, I think, was a Belvedere. It was green and white, and it was a four-door.
Now, this was a two-door Fury hardtop.
And you remember those little chrome blades on the front fender?
Yeah.
You know, those marker things. I was serious. I sat in the front seat most of that trip while Bobby slept in the back, and Mary drove. And I was sitting there looking at those chrome things, and I barely could see past them. It was like, where are we going? But we got there, and I just didn't want to cross that bridge coming back. And do they still make Cocoa Krispies? I don't even know.
I don't know, but I sure am glad that bridge that you're speaking of has been blown up and gone.
Oh, is it gone?
Yes,
oh, my God.
Gone.
They should have called me, and I would have come down there and sung the national anthem for that.
I have been over it a few times before they got rid of it, and I was probably about as terrified as you. Well, that was really, really a scary trip.
They used to have three of them in a row, Georgetown, Charleston, and Savannah.
Yeah,
they're all pretty.
Yep.
Well, the thing about that one going into Savannah, if you remember, when you got up to the very top, it was those grates. You know, it wasn't asphalt or anything anymore. You were going across steel grates.
Just like the one going into Wilmington.
Yep.
Yeah, and when we hit those things going across that bridge, I thought that was the end of my life at 13 years old.
And the car would do the hucklebuck on it because those grates weren't all in line, and that it would cause the car to jump up and down and sway and lurch. You just knew that the thing was going to give away, and you were going through it.
Yeah, I know. This memory is coming back so vivid now. I'm holding on to both arms of my chair like, Lord, help me.
Try driving a 13,000-pound motor home over it when you distrust it to start with a car. that was one of those back when I smoked that I called a three-cigarette bridge.
All right, Bopper, you're up, buddy.
Tim, before I forget it, got an errand for you to do down in Columbia there, and this comes through our colleague Jack Walker has evidence that there is some kind of activity going on at the new Columbia Speedway.
Not Jack Walker.
Yes, the Jack Walker.
Well, I went out there about 2 weeks ago, and it looks like there's some dirt that's been hauled in. Some clay that's been hauled in.
Need to check it out.
Yeah. I can't get to it till Thursday, but I'll certainly do it. Well, how much clay are we talking about, Jack?
Well, I don't know. It looked like some piles down in the, I guess it'd be the second turn, maybe.
Check it out and report it back to us on
give or take three wheelbarrows.
Goat Rodeo.
No, I'll check it out, but that could be a boat across. That could be leveling it up.
I didn't see any equipment or anything like that, though.
That could be Bobby Seller stealing clay.
It could be.
Bobby, if you hear this, that was a joke.
I don't know who's listening.
I dug back in the old archive, since Daytona's coming up, to something that I did not know. I kind of knew it and didn't know it at the same time. And Jack, you might relate to this. A number 47 coupe has been a part of early NASCAR off and on with different drivers, but all of them having a lot of success back in the day, especially on the beach road course.
Like Tim Flock, I think.
Yeah, Tim Flock won the 1956 modified sportsman race on the old beach road course, driving the number 47. Also, there is some film of 1952 modified race at Daytona that NASCAR runs a lot in their various promos, their historical promos, and it shows a black number 47 Ford coupe. It shows that a lot, and that car I think was driven by Jimmy Lou Allen in that particular race.
I'm trying to remember. Didn't somebody named Wolf own that car?
That's what I'm getting to.
Oh, it is? Well, I'm sorry. You jumped right in there.
Yeah, thanks there for stealing my thunder, Gentleman Jack. And also, let's see, the number 47 even predates 1952. Fonnie Flock won the 1949 NASCAR Modified Championship. This would have been the second year of its existence, driving the number 47 car. And the car's owner was, as you pointed out, Joe Wolf, a guy named Joe Wolf, who, as it turns out, was quite an accomplished automotive guy. I knew the cars, and see, the last time I think the really last claim to fame of the Joe Wolf coupes was the same one that Tim Flock drove in 1956. Junior Johnson drove the same car on the big track in 1959 at the first modified sportsman race, and it was a 39 Chevrolet coupe. But the thing that everybody remembered about it was it had a I was thinking it had a Cadillac engine. It had an Oldsmobile engine that had been set back 26 inches rear.
Oh, my gosh, 26 inches.
Yeah, 26 inches. So everything in the car, you know, I mean, the driver, the steering wheel, everything had to be moved back accordingly.
So he was like a backseat driver.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
But anyway, the car, well, they were racing modified, so it fit the rules. The fans at Daytona said it looked like nobody was driving the car when it would come by because you couldn't see anybody in the front seat. But it was this same car that had run on the beach, and Junior qualified fourth for the first. That's what I was looking on your site for, the 1959. He qualified fourth. I don't exactly know where he finished because he was disqualified. The car, believe it or not, had an oversized gas tank.
Huh.
But that's modified. Why not have an oversized?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It was So, who was Joe Wolf anyway? Joe Wolf was born in 1910 in Reading, Pennsylvania. So, see, you know about that, don't you, Jack?
Yep.
He attended the General Motors Institute at Lansing, Michigan from 1940 to 1946. He was employed by Lockheed Aircraft Corporation in Burbank, California. In 1942, he worked with Howard Hughes as a consulting engineer in preparation of the first flight of the Lockheed Constellation aircraft. So this is a pretty technical dude. All right. Joe returned to Reading, Pennsylvania, and opened his Hollywood Speed Shop at 541 North 4th Street. Now, listen to this. In 1949, Bill France Sr. of NASCAR asked Joe to build him an Indy car. You ever know that? Big Bill was wanting to run Indy in 49. But Joe couldn't commit because he was in the process of moving his garage to a new location. The shop was relocated to 1154 North Front Street, where he remained in business until his death on October 20th, 1966. Joe was an internationally top-rated mechanic and an expert on racing engines. He also took to the cockpit and was a stock car and hydroplane pilot along the Atlantic seaboard for many years, winning the Hydroplane Eastern Regional Championship in 1956. Joe's car won the 1949 NASCAR Modified Championship with driver Fonnie Flock at the wheel. His cars raced on the Daytona Beach course throughout the 1950s, winning in 1956 with Tim Flock. Junior Johnson later drove for him. His number 47 Chevmobile was known as the backseat bomber. In order to achieve a more even weight distribution, better balance, and traction, he moved the engine back 26 inches. This forced removal of the front seat and put the driver in the back seat. Spectators said it looked as if nobody was driving the car as it sped by. After winning at Daytona in 1956, Tim Flock said to take this thing home and wrap it in cellophane. And don't let nobody touch it. It's the hottest car I have ever driven. So, here is another tidbit, trying to find info on Joe Wolf. I got to the Ham Jalopy forum, and here's a post that says, my father worked for Joe at Hollywood Speed Shop in Reading, and I credit his success as beginning with Joe. I have some photos and actually have Joe's little black book from back in the 50s and later. It is amazing. It has the engine specs from the Chevmobile and tons of others, including dyno figures. My favorite entry into it is a fuel mixture with full details, including benzene and, quote, a Coke bottle full of nitromethane. Wonder if Junior then was running that.
Wonder what, how many ounces that Coke bottle was.
Probably six. Six. That was back then. That was the standard Coke.
Yeah. A Coke bottle full of nitromethane into something that already had benzene.
I bet that smelled funny.
It has the home. This black book has the home phone numbers and addresses of Bill France Sr., Lee Petty, Junior Johnson, all the Flocks, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, Dwayne Church, Ed Iskaderian, and a Bobby Allison business card as a Purolator representative.
Whose book is this?
This is Joe Wolf's personal black book that this fellow obtained because his dad used to work at the garage.
Oh, okay. And
Dean Martin was in it.
And Dean Martin's phone number and Jerry Lewis.
Probably had June Wilkinson in there, too.
Yeah.
41, 41, 36, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I am still using one of Joe's engine stands to this day at my shop, and best of all, another of Joe's employee disciples, Sam Reber, hangs out at my place. He helped build that car and tons of others and went on to build motors for Bobby Gerhart, Kenny Brightbill, and tons of others. That the race can't win is ridiculous. I'm thrilled to know these guys draw from the knowledge base. I'm sure he could answer more questions than they have, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a name that somehow had escaped us all this time, but he was a big player.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day, in the early NASCAR Beach Road days. So,
speaking where was he from, Robert?
Reading, Pennsylvania.
Yep.
Speaking of Daytona, go around the list. Everybody tell what year was your first Daytona experience?
62.
You're going there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mine was 64.
Bobby?
Kind of like Tim's. We left in the middle of the night and drove all night.
71 was my first time.
69.
14.
14. 14
when we went to the Bill trip.
We run over every mailbox post and stop sign between Shallotte and Daytona.
Yep. How about you, Kodai?
Well, I've never been, but I guess the first time I saw one was 04.
There you go. Folks, we're going to have to ride on that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for putting this thing together. That was great. Thanks to all you fans that hung out there and listened to us. Back to food. We love you. We need you. As always, we want to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve our military. Thank you for doing that so that we can do this. To each and every one of you, good night, and God bless.